The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is 1:30 in the afternoon, 1:32 or 3 in the afternoon, on Thursday, March the 15th, the Ides of March. There is a quorum present. Senator Wilikowski is here, Senator Huggins is here, and myself, Senator French. This is the Judiciary Committee. We are hearing four bills on the docket this afternoon. Let's start with SB 64, which we spent quite a bit of time on last session. You have a new work draft in front of you that incorporates the changes we made yesterday. It's backslash M. I would
move backslash M.
M is the document now before us. The committee members will note that the two substantive amendments made yesterday, amendment number one is incorporated now into section 1 and section 10 of the bill. It's the bribery provision. So that's section 1 and section 10. And the aircraft provision is incorporated in sections 8 and sections 9. Otherwise, the bill is exactly as it was before, with the sections renumbered to take into account the provisions we've added. Are there any questions or comments from members of the committee? What is the will of the committee with respect to CS for Senate Bill number 64?
Mr. Chairman, I move that CS for Senate Bill 64, version M, as amended with individual comments and attached physical note, be moved from committee.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the Senate bill is on its way to the State Affairs Committee. Brief recess. Judiciary Committee will come back to order. It is 1:36. Next up for us this afternoon is CS for Senate Bill number 89. There is a backslash E CS before us. If I would solicit a motion to adopt the CS.
Move echo.
Thank you. The echo version is now before us. The bill is sponsored by Senator Wilikowski. We have him here today, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Just speak. There are a couple minor changes to this bill. The previous bill addressed gang members on probation but did not specifically include parolees. Upon request of the criminal division, we've added a new section that includes parolees. And we also, at the advice of the Department of Corrections, we removed the word continuous from this legislation in order to give the department some leeway in administering the program in a cost-effective manner. By removing the word continuous, the fiscal note dropped, we think, fairly significantly. There's now an indeterminate fiscal note, although they estimate, if my recollection, as I'm looking at this, that it's dropped. I guess down to, looks like the general funds will be about $195,000, and I think the prior fiscal note had been up to $1 million. So the advantage, the technology, I was very fortunate this past weekend to be home at a constituent meeting, and I met some constituents who actually do this type of work, and they are able to manage these types of they actually do exactly this for pre-sentencing people, and they had a essentially a BlackBerry, and every time someone, they had it programmed so that whenever someone moved out of a certain zone or into a certain zone, they would get a little beep on their BlackBerry. And and then they would contact the person and say, what are you doing, to verify what was occurring. And that is a much more passive management style than someone sitting there in a room watching 15 different, several different monitors perhaps. So we think that taking out the continuous will have a fairly significant impact on that.
Questions from members of the committee for Senator Wilikowski? I see Mr. Peoples in the audience. I have a question for him. If you come forward, we heard, we had some discussion today about ankle bracelets in a subcommittee on corrections. And the number I recall from, it was not more than like 3 hours ago, we talked about this, and the number I recall was something like $40 per day to supervise someone on an ankle monitor. Is that the same cost estimate that you've applied to this bill and this idea? If you put yourself on the record, thank you.
For the record, my name is Dwayne Peoples, Department of Corrections. To the chair's question, on the fiscal note where we did an indeterminate, if you go to the second page, in response to the last time we discussed this bill, I was requested to try to break out a series of scenarios. So I broke those out working with the sponsor staff from both houses. And you will see that the passive model, you can walk through and break out if we were to be basically monitoring these people within reason. You would have one PO for about 40 offenders. So if you go to the right-hand corner column there, you will see a 1-to-40 ratio. And that's how the costs break out. So that's how we came up with with this calculation. It would probably, the $40 a day was the system that we are working with under releasing inmates from institutions under furlough. Like we'd put them in a halfway house, a community residential center, or on electronic monitoring. And it's fairly comparable to this. We do not use GPS in that role. We use basically the telephone modules. But this is how it would break out. The cost we have given you is a little high. These are the first year cost where we would have startup cost of buying computers and vests and so forth for a new probation officer. So I've tried to meet what I believed was the request of the committee from last time to look at various financial models.
Thank you. Actually, now that I have a moment to look at this, I see that the daily cost per offender is lower, is $17. They're under in the third sort of under revenues. There's a line that says estimate of collections. Is that with the idea in mind that you'd be charging probationers for their own ankle bracelet?
To the chair, yes, sir. That's what we try to do. We try to collect about $17 a day. Sometimes we're not very successful in the furlough program. We don't collect all of it. Sometimes we waive the requirements for collections just to help relieve our population management. But this is the proposal that we would come up with. Again, this is sort of estimates, but we would be trying to recover under the scenario of 1 to 40 about $75,000 a year out of the operating cost.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Peoples while he's here? Thank you, sir, for your testimony. The only question I guess I have left for the sponsor is we had a sort of a policy discussion last time about whether to go with a special condition of probation or whether which requires a higher burden of proof, if you will, on the prosecution, or whether to go with a general condition. And you made a policy call to go with a special condition. If you could just put that on the record, I think that'd be good for the public to know.
You're going to have to refresh my recollection on that.
And maybe Ms. Carpinetti is here, and maybe you can help us out with the difference between a special condition and a general condition. But my understanding is that a special condition of probation, or the way this is set up, is that it is you'd have to prove that the person is a member of a criminal street gang in order to have this condition apply. Whereas if you set it up as a general condition, it would apply to anybody convicted of a felon as long as there was some nexus between the crime they committed and criminal street gangs. It's a lower burden of proof.
The Chair, the way the bill is drafted, my name is Annie Carpinetti. In order to have this condition of probation, right now it's pegged to the finding of the aggravating factor, which is AS 1255-155C-29, and we believe this may be a Blakely factor. It is a factor that we would have to prove to the fact finder, the jury, beyond a reasonable doubt, the way it's connected to an aggravating factor. Another way of doing it, and I think Mr. Swobodny was here, and he suggested just having it as a general condition of probation where you would not have to go through that that procedure, which you have to do with every aggravating factor now, unless under Blakely, unless it's connected to a prior conviction.
Sure. So in order for this condition to apply, essentially the grand jury and then a trial jury will both have to find that the crime was committed by a member of a criminal street gang.
Correct. Or for the benefit of the way the criminal street gang is defined in Title 11, it's fairly strict definition, and I think that's one of the reasons why this, I'm not sure exactly why it was drafted this way, but that's what we would have to prove.
That's the effect of it.
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
I remember the discussion. I sat through several hours of a G yesterday, and my mind had been completely refocused. I remember the discussion. The discussion was, and I believe Mr. Svobodny had recommended, well, why don't we just make this a special condition for anyone who's on parole or on probation. And we just felt that that would have driven the fiscal note through the ceiling. And so we did decide, just from a financial standpoint, that we wanted to limit it to those who met the aggravating factor under 1255-155-C-29. But I'm open.
It's a fair position. And it may be that this discussion is more suited for the finance table, for the finance table to decide where to set the level of individuals that are going to be subject to an ankle monitor. Mm-hmm. The legalisms are, we're sort of confronting the legal question. Shall it be narrow and apply to all, or should it be broader and apply to a few? And I'm going to defer to the bill sponsor.
We were trying to keep the cost down. This is a program that has worked successfully in San Bernardino with gang members. My goal in introducing this legislation was to deal with the gang problem, which is becoming more prevalent in Anchorage, and to try to keep gang members from congregating so that we could track gang members on parole. If they do congregate, if they do go into areas they're not supposed to, we'll have an idea. We'll have it pinpointed on global positioning system. That was just a policy call that we made more to keep the cost down. This could be expanded to any number of people on parole or probation, but it's finances.
And I just wanted us to make a heads up, eyes wide open policy call. While we've got the bill in our committee. Senator Huggins.
My recommendation is to keep it narrower, but I have a concern with that, and it's a legal concern of the sense of criminal A gets out, crime, kill someone, whatever, a heinous crime, and then we, the state, are held liable because they really were a gang criminal, didn't have a tracking device on, and why didn't you conform with your law? You owe us X amount of money. That's the concern I have.
It's a valid question. It's always hard to let me just put it another way. It's difficult to overcome the criminal's own sort of culpability,
right,
a responsibility for his bad behavior. There's lots of folks who'd love to sue on a criminal's bad act and blame someone else for his bad act. But it's just tough. It's a tough legal doctrine. Otherwise, you know, the state, the jailer, the DA, the judge, we'd all be hauled into court constantly and forced to explain why this guy wasn't in jail when he was out committing a crime.
Yeah, and I think it would be an extremely difficult case for anyone to go against the state on that. I mean, we've made a policy call that this will apply to gang members. But
I think on a smaller scope, we get the benefit of having the program operate in a smaller group of people, and then we can always expand it.
Come back next year and
And we can really get a look at what it does cost.
Sure.
To produce cannabis.
Sure. Fair enough. Good discussion. Thank you, Ms. Carpenetti. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee about the bill? Anybody here in the room or online wanting to testify about Senate Bill 89? Hearing and seeing none, what is the will of the committee with respect to Senate Bill 89?
Mr. Chair, I move that CS for Senate Bill 89 version echo as amended with individual comments and attached physical note be moved from committee.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, Senate Bill 89 is moved on. Take another short recess for the paperwork. Judiciary Committee will come back to order. Next up is CS for Senate Bill number 7. We have the bill sponsor, the staff of the bill sponsor here, and we have a CS in front of us. The backslash is Lima. The chairman would entertain a motion to adopt the working document.
I move Lima.
It is in front of us. The CS, actually I'll walk the committee through it since it was prepared as much as from as you know from my input as much as from anybody else's. The idea behind the CS is to draw some distinctions, if you will, amongst felons, and the idea is to draw distinctions amongst them according to the category of crime they committed and the crime that sent them off to prison. You can see those categories broken out in lines 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13 of page 1. The idea is to continue under the system as it exists, that is, to not restore the rights of felons who are let out of jail if you've been convicted of an unclassified felony or a Class A felony, the most serious felonies, murder, rape, and so forth. Likewise, you would not restore the voting rights of someone who's released from prison who's ever been convicted of a felony in the past. So if you're a repeat felon, you've got to go through all the hoops. So that would, at least to my mind, stratify things so that people who are convicted of felony DWI or some other lower level crime, when they get out of jail, fine, they can go back and start voting. If you've been convicted of rape or robbery, murder, sorry, you don't get to vote. You've got to go through more hoops before you ever get your right to vote back. That's really sort of the policy call embedded in the bill itself. The other sections of the bill are essentially conforming amendments to make those changes work under the Division of Elections. As it stands right now, of course, the division only restores your rights once you've been out and completed all the conditions of your probation. Now you have two classes, one group of felons that are restricted, another group that's allowed to vote upon release. There is one amendment that I've been asked to make on the CS by Whitney Brewster, the Division of Elections director, and that is on page 2, line 15. I could turn your attention to that portion of the bill. Page 2, line 15 currently reads, and this is when it's talking about the director, it means the director of the Division of Elections. It says the director shall make reasonable efforts to obtain the names of persons convicted of a felony involving moral turpitude. The request is to amend that to say the Commissioner of Corrections shall notify the director of the names of persons convicted of a felony involving moral turpitude. It just seems like it's, that's the commission of, the corrections are the folks that actually have that information. They're in a better position to have that information instead of putting the onus on the Division of Elections to find that out. Why not put it on the state officials that have that information? So the idea is to make the language consistent with the language immediately above that. You'll see up on lines 10 through 12 on page 2, it says the Commissioner of Corrections shall notify, etc. So I will make that amendment, amendment number 1 to the bill being 2 on page 2, line 15, delete the director shall make reasonable efforts to obtain, and replace that with the Commissioner of Corrections shall notify the director of. That's amendment number 1. Senator Wilkowski objects for the purposes of discussion. Go ahead.
Just on the wording of that, it would seem to me that it would be appropriate to say the Commissioner of Corrections shall notify the director, and then the director shall make reasonable efforts to obtain the names. Is that what your intent was?
This is language that came to me from the Division of Elections, so my intent is maybe we, is there someone here can... Sure. My aide will come around, and she had the conversation with the division, so we can close the communication loop here. If you'd put yourself on the record, we'd be eager to hear your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Cindy Smith. I'm an aide to Senator French. I was contacted by the Division of Elections this morning with this request, and the reason you don't need both those things, Senator, is because the information that's transmitted from the Department of Corrections includes the name and other identifiers that Elections needs in order to contact the person. So as above on line 10, the notification, and Mr. Peoples can also speak to this, just routinely goes over as an electronic transmittal.
Mr. Peoples, would you like to weigh in on this just so we have a clear record?
For the record, my name is Dwayne Peoples, Department of Corrections. The department can provide the information to anybody, the Department of Elections, giving the name and identifiers who were convicted and released during a period of time, just like the file that we gave you, sir, a list of moral turpitude charges, the numbers. We could have provided you the name.
Sure.
We do the similar with the Permanent Fund Dividend Corporation to seize PFDs from felons.
Further questions, Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, just looking at line 17, everything else remains the same. Promptly after receipt of evidence satisfactory to the director, that remains the same. And then line 19, it refers to director also. That those all remain the same.
Those remain the same.
Okay. Thank you. We're not going to move this. It's not your intent to move this today, is it, Mr. Chairman?
I think the sense I'm getting from the committee is we need to, you know, have some more time with the bill.
I would just like to see it in writing so I can see it in front of me and feel a little more comfortable at that point, at least with that provision.
Fair enough. Back to the amendment. Are you removing your objection with respect to amendment number 1?
Yes.
Is there further objection to amendment number 1? Hearing and seeing none, amendment number 1 is adopted. We do have Michael McLeod Ball on the line from the ACLU. Mr. McLeod Ball, can you hear me?
Mr. Chairman, I can. Can you hear me?
I can. If you'd put yourself on the record, I'd have a couple questions for you.
Sure. My name is Michael McLeod Ball. I'm the Executive Director of the ACLU of Alaska.
Mr. McLeod Ball, let me just ask you this. This bill, as you know, sets up a scheme that separates felons into categories by the seriousness of the offense for which they were convicted. Do you see any constitutional problems with making with stratifying and changing the rights of prisoners based on the seriousness of their conviction?
I don't, Mr. Chairman. We have done some research on this issue, and there's not a lot of guiding case law on this. We had some folks do some research in other states and still found not a lot that was directly on point to guide us on this issue. But generally speaking, the legislature does have some authority to attempt to define terminology that's used, just as the courts do, in interpreting constitutional provisions. And we think that that what you're trying to do here is essentially no different, except by degree, of what was already in the statutes previously. So to the extent that you assume that what was already in the statutes previously was permissible under the Constitution, then we believe this should be as well.
Thank you. That's the question I had. Any other questions from members of the committee for Mr. McLeod? Ball, while we have him on the line. Sir, do you have any other comments or observations about the bill itself?
Mr. Chairman, we believe this is a step in the right direction. The original form of the bill, of course, would have brought more felons into the onto the voting rolls, and so from a policy perspective, we preferred that. But this still is a step in the right direction, and we appreciate the work that this committee and you and your colleagues have done on this.
Senator Huggins has a question.
Yeah, Mr. McLeod, Ball, Charlie Huggins here. Where statistically, in what states would it put us in the same area in voting rights?
The volume is a little low with respect to, for you, Senator Huggins, so I'm not quite sure I made it out. But
right.
I believe,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I believe that one of my colleagues from our New York office testified as to some of the statistics at the last hearing. There are a couple of states that that do not disenfranchise felons at all. There are a couple of states that permanently remove voting rights from felons upon conviction, and the vast majority of the states are somewhere in between. And there, I believe Senator Davis' staffer also had some numbers on that. Suffice to say that we would be moving within that great majority of states that are in the middle.
Yeah, the note I see says 21 states, including Alaska. Would this still keep us in that group of 21, or is this a description of what it would move us to?
I believe the groups that you're talking about have let me see if I can explain this in a way that's clear. I believe that large number in the middle bring felons back onto the voting rolls at some time, and there are a variety of distinctions that are made in the states as to when they're brought back on the rolls or for what crimes they lose the voting rights in the first place. And so I view the change that's being proposed here as being just a variation within that group.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions for Mr. McLeod Ball? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much for testifying before us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Anybody else here in the room that wants to testify on Senate Bill number 7? Hearing and seeing none, we'll carry this bill forward to the next committee hearing for the preparation of the amended language and for further consideration by the full committee. And that brings us to SB 36, Sentencing for Alcohol-Related Crimes. I see the Mr. Stancliffe is here to make a presentation on behalf of his boss, for lack of a better word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
The record.
My name is Dave Stancliffe. I'm staff assistant to Senator Terrio, and beside me is Jessica Feldman, who will be in the future carrying this bill, and this is kind of an easing in of her to have her before a committee and get used to the process before the bill file gets put in front of her. So if that's okay, we'd like to have her here beside me.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The bill before you is based on really three things. The first being that when some people come into contact with enough alcohol, alcohol turns them into people who are very violent, and when that violence becomes a criminal activity and a serious enough crime, this bill would allow judges, as part of the sentencing options, to be able to remove that alcohol for a period of time up to a lifetime based on factors to be decided by the prosecutor, the defense, and the judge and a jury. The other part of this bill has to do with people who have committed serious offenses with regard to DUIs. In other words, more than two DUIs, and or a DUI that has resulted in a serious physical injury. And that, Mr. Chairman, I believe you had something to do with adding in previous in the bill's history. The purpose of the bill really is to protect people. If you can imagine someone who has served some time for a very serious offense, a violent offense, and who perhaps goes on probation, and part of the probation condition is that they refrain from the use of alcohol, and they do just fine until the probation is up and they return to the pattern of drinking and alcohol behavior that once again starts them down this path to violence. If you, of course, follow the papers and you follow the crimes that involve alcohol, and there are so many of them, it plays such a great role in so many violent crimes in today's world. What people don't realize is behind all of that are volumes of studies that connect alcohol and the way certain people react when they use alcohol. There's a physiological change, something as basic as a massive amounts and releases of testosterone for some males that consume alcohol, to very subtle changes in brain activity. But the results are consistent across the board. Some people, when they use alcohol, have a propensity to do great violence. The protective part of this measure is that before a person conducts violent behavior again, and before more victims are created, there would be a way for people to interdict and say, this person is back on alcohol again, they're not supposed to be on alcohol, our village or our family or our community is at danger because they're back into this use of alcohol, and the person could then, before the violence occurs, be basically taken into custody. This is not a mandatory option. It's one we don't see that will be used very frequently. We do see it as perhaps in some cases an alternative to a much longer prison sentence if the person agrees, is willing to go through treatment. And in the previous committee, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's a provision to also use therapeutic courts in lieu of this particular option. The third part of it has to do with changing the way our culture and our young people view alcohol. You know, we have no problem viewing drugs as being bad for us and taking those off the table with regard to how people react when they're on them. We have no problem in some instances removing firearms from people who are felons, and as you were just discussing, in some instances voting rights. Young people grow up thinking that alcohol, thinking of alcohol and drinking as a right and not necessarily a privilege. And this would probably begin a path of, and a different perspective with regard to, yes, a right to happiness is important under our Constitution, but the misuse of alcohol in certain instances by certain people under very strict conditions could jeopardize it and the use of it. So this is a novel approach. It's a very serious approach, one that we see would be used very infrequently, but a tool in the sentencing option package that Senator Terrio felt judges ought to have in this day of age of recidivism in violence with alcohol. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stancliff. Questions for members of the committee for Mr. Stancliff? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. The well, and maybe this is a question for legal, but I see there's a finding on page 3, line 15, that the court find by clear and convincing evidence, and trying to think back to my criminal law days, whether you can have such a standard in a criminal case or in a situation like this, or whether it has to be by beyond a reasonable doubt.
I think the short answer is yes. I mean, the guilty verdict, of course, has to be supported by the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, but there are other sentencing factors that sometimes come with different standards of proof. But we have an expert right here in the room. And Ms. Carpinetti's probably saying to herself, I should have left a little while ago. If you'd come forward, please, Ms. Carpinetti, maybe you can answer Senator Wilikowski's record.
Oh, she's not going to move this.
Question okay. for the record.
I'm going to use that.
Okay, I understand. Yep, we'll wrap up.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Annie Carpinetti. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. And fortunately, I had a conversation with Doug Kossler this afternoon about this very bill. So I got his expert opinion about whether or not this would be a Blakely factor or not. And we concluded that it probably would not be, and that this standard of proof could be supported, clear and convincing evidence. He did have a suggestion, which I'd like to pass on to you.
We'd be eager to hear it.
That's the legal shop that supports, you know, that litigates the validity of legislation. And he suggested that since paragraph B on page 3, there are two bases on which a court could impose up to a lifetime prohibition on alcohol. One is if a person is convicted of a crime against a person. And also under B is a person is convicted of drunk driving on numerous occasions. B has a standard for protection of the public, and he suggested that we add that to paragraph A also, that the court should make a finding that this condition was necessary for the protection of the public. Because, you know, I hate to sound lax on drunk drivers, and I don't feel that way at all, but, you know, there could be a first-time drunk driver who gets convicted of third-degree assault, which is a felony, by breaking somebody's leg, you know, something that is serious physical injury, but, that would fit under this provision unless the court found that it was necessary for the protection of the public to have this long-time condition. So we would suggest you consider that.
You're saying, just to rephrase or to paraphrase, you're saying that this paragraph A, lines 14 to 17 would be more defensible if it had the requirement that the judge make a finding that the imposition of the condition was to protect the public,
just like it does in B.
We'll take that under advisement, Senator Wilikowski.
I'm not really tracking why that might be problematic to not have that.
Well, there are some decisions, a condition of probation has to have some rational relationship to the crime that was committed and the offender himself or herself. And there could be, it's hard to imagine, but there could be a drunk driver who assaults somebody and does not cause death, but it's a felony against a person. And you wouldn't want a court to be able to impose a lifetime prohibition of drinking on somebody under circumstances where it wasn't necessary to protect the public.
Would that be a constitutional problem? That would make the law unconstitutional? I mean, or I guess an excessive, cruel and unusual, or excessive punishment?
Yeah, well,
just not really tracking.
Assault in the third degree is a Class C felony, 5 years maximum term of imprisonment. A lifetime condition that the person doesn't drink is a lot longer than 5 years, maximum five-year term in jail. So you want to have it make sense. Yes, and it could be. I'm not saying that it would fall, but we think it would be more defensible and make more sense to have a protection of the public.
But couldn't you, if someone raped someone and they were under the influence and it's the first time they ever did it and there wasn't a whole lot of proof that it would happen again, because that's probably hard to prove, I would imagine, couldn't we as policymakers say, you know what, you committed this heinous act and you've lost your right to drink for the rest of your life or for the next 40 years. I guess I'm just not tracking why we wouldn't be able to do that as a policy call.
Well, there has to be, courts generally hold that there should be some proportionality in terms of punishment for the act that a person commits. I think even a first-time rape case would be certainly more defensible. And I'm not saying it wouldn't be if a person got into a drunk driver got into an accident and broke somebody's leg, but I'm just saying that it makes sense to require the court to make a finding that this lifetime prohibition of drinking is for the protection of the public, both in paragraph A and paragraph B.
I think one of the, at least I'm grasping, the point you're making is that if you found the most severe penalty imposed for the least severe felony, that there'd be such an imbalance there that without the finding that it was necessary to protect the public, you'd have a hard time defending that sentence in the Court of Appeals.
It would be harder to do so. It's just a question of proportionality.
Right. It's unlikely, probably, that you would get that.
It's unlikely that the court would impose it under those circumstances, but.
But the law allows it as it's written.
Yes.
You could get a lifetime ban for the least serious felony.
Yes.
And I'm sure Mr. Kossler is thinking down the road 12 months to when he has to defend this law,
mm-hmm.
and he's thinking it'll be a lot easier if the judge has made a more specific finding about why he's imposing or she's imposing that condition.
That's correct.
I guess I do have some concerns over that change. I think the judge should have the leeway, and I understand what you're saying about the proportionality. There needs to be proportionality, and I guess under A or B, there still could be one that was a sentence that could be disproportionate. But I guess I just have some concerns. I don't want to limit a judge's ability to restrict someone from using alcohol for a heinous offense. And I don't know that we run into constitutional. I mean, you're always going to have that constitutional proportionality issue, but I think we're taking away something else by adding what you're requesting that we add, and I'm not sure I necessarily want to do that.
Okay.
But I need to think about it some more.
Well, it's kind of interesting to me because, you know, if I was comparing A and B, I would probably want the finding under A, I think it would be more necessary under A than under B. Because if a person is on his third time drunk driving, it's much more defensible to me that it would to have a lifetime prohibition of drinking. That's another reason I think why, if you're going to be comparing the two and only having one, it probably ought to be under A.
Maybe you could get, I feel like we've been sort of cross-examining Mr. Kossler through you, which is difficult, and I appreciate your good nature. Maybe he could type up a one or two, paragraph email on his thinking, and that way we could make it part of the record and, mm-hmm. might help inform our thinking.
Okay.
Thanks so much. Other questions for Ms. Carpenetti while we have her in the hot seat? Thank you. Mr. Stancliffe, I think I asked this the last committee hearing this bill was up in, but just remind me, have other states taken this approach, or are we unique in this criminalizing the consumption of alcohol idea?
We'd be, as far as I've been able to determine, totally unique.
Thank you very much. Other questions for Mr. Stancliffe?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Anybody else here in the room want to testify on the Senate bill? Anybody online? Oh, here we are. Beg your pardon. Here's somebody right here. Please come forward and put yourself on the record. We'd be eager to hear your testimony.
My name is Michelle Atherton Hess. I'm with the Division of Behavioral Health. I just have a couple of quick comments, actually.
Please go ahead.
We do support the idea of increasing public safety for violent felons, and we support the intent of this CS. However, there's a couple of concerns that the division and the Department of Health and Social Services has. Specifically, our concern is that while we understand from what Mr. Stancliffe just testified on, that the interdiction aspect of it would come from concerned family members and citizens of the community to get people back into a secure setting to increase public safety, there's been a dwindling amount of dollars in the prison systems, which has been taking away substance abuse treatment in prisons. And that has not been addressed in this particular bill. I don't know if that can be addressed in this bill, but I think that that's something that needs to be closely looked at here. So that is our number one concern. As people kind of cycle back through the system, there's a lack of treatment in prison systems.
It's a valid concern. I appreciate you bringing it up. I think I may have mentioned in connection with another bill today that I sit on the corrections budget subcommittee,
mm-hmm.
and the corrections department is asking for a budget of $241 million this year to cover 5,500 inmates and 5,500 parolees for basically a cost of $22,000 a year. Mm-hmm. per Department of Corrections customer, if you will. So I at least in the middle of the day, I was mindful of the fact that every time we pass a law and make someone a convict, we've handed the state of Alaska a bill for about $22,000.
Yeah.
And I think we do have to be mindful of that as we consider passing new laws. But thank you very much for being here. Any other questions, Senator Woodlock?
Yeah, if someone has a substance abuse problem now and they are in the correction system, what is there no treatment, or what happens to them? I mean,
there's limited to no treatment in the prison system right now. Those treatment programs were basically axed with the last administration, and so when they're released back into the community, they're, as a condition of probation, they're required to go through maybe some sort of substance abuse program if they had alcohol or other drug as a part of their crime. And so then they're going to community-based drug and alcohol programs, which are grant-funded through the Division of Behavioral Health. But again, if they are convicted of a violent crime and then this bill passes, where a judge can, as a tool in his toolbox, sentence them to a lifetime ban on alcohol, they'll just continue to cycle through the system and go into a prison system that has no substance abuse treatment. So while they're in prison, perhaps for up to a year, that's a prime opportunity to treat that person for a substance abuse problem. Well, that's great. When they're in, they won't have any treatment. But when they get out, then they can access treatment.
So you're saying essentially it's probably expected, and I think studies show that people will be convicted. They'll, under this, get out, and they'll be on probation, maybe have a lifetime ban. They'll get caught drinking. They'll go back to jail. They'll serve another year or so, get released, get caught drinking again. That's the kind of revolving door scenario you're envisioning.
Right. My previous life as a probation officer, I used to tell my clients, lack of access does not constitute treatment.
Senator Wilkowski.
Didn't even think to look as far as a corrections fiscal note. Is there one?
The fiscal note that I have is from the Department of Law, and it's an indeterminate fiscal note for the record. There is an analysis on page 2 that describes what the bill does and how it would work. My quick review of the fiscal note does not reveal any discussion of treatment. It's more an analysis of the impact on the Department of Law.
Is there a corrections fiscal note, Mr. Chair?
My helpful aide has just brought that to my attention. There is a there is one from the Department of Corrections. It was put out on the 23rd of February. It is an indeterminate fiscal note. The analysis says the Department of Corrections cannot determine fiscal impacts of this legislation. Data is not available for the department to calculate the number of offenders that would not comply with the sentencing requirements. There's also a fiscal note from the Public Defender Agency prepared by Quinlan Steiner, and it is also a indeterminate fiscal note. It says in relevant part, the agency cannot reliably predict the fiscal impact of this legislation, and so forth.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anybody online to testify about Senate Bill 36? Hearing and seeing none, we will carry this bill over into the next committee hearing. Any other matters to come before the committee today? Hearing and seeing none, we are adjourned.